What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Ever notice your dog slowing down and having health issues and wonder, what can I do to make them better? Well, my friend, add Rough Greens to your dog's food for 90 days and I guarantee you'll see changes that will amaze you. Greetings, naturopathic Dr. Dennis Black, inventor of Rough Greens here, and I invite you to give your pup the Rough Greens 90-Day Challenge. In the first 30 days, you'll see shinier coats and increased energy. By day 60, your dog will have a stronger immune system, less shedding, improved joint function, all due to the live nutrients that you've added to their diet. And at 90 days, better digestion, reduced inflammation, improved heart health, and you may even have reduced their cancer risk. Fetch your dog a free Jumpstart trial bag today. Go to tryroughgreens.com. Use promo code TRYRUFF. That's TRYRUFF. Go to tryroughgreens.com. Use promo code TRYRUFF. You just cover the shipping. You don't have to change your dog's food to improve your dog's health. Just add a scoop of Rough Greens.
Dude, that's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to The Smiley Show, and we have a great one for you today coming off the 125th U.S. Open at Oakmont. I'm Charlie Hume, and I am the only person you're going to hear from today that is not a member of the NBC Sports broadcast team. He is, of course, Smiley Kaufman, and we have Kevin Kisner and Dan Hicks joining us in the wake of an incredible finish at Oakmont. And these conversations, Smiley, are presented by our friends at Ahead. Today, we're talking about trust-based relationships. Ahead builds and manages digital platforms that power the most successful organizations in the world. Their consultative approach, unmatched engineering, and innovative solutions combine to accelerate the impact of technology in every client they serve. Ahead's longstanding relationships are built on outcomes and experience with both their clients and technology partners. You can learn more at ahead.com. Smiley, you have incredible relationships with both Kiz and Dan Hicks. So here's where I want to start is just give us a little, we're going to open with Kiz, tease a little excerpt of that interview that you really enjoyed that you want the audience to kind of key in on.
Well, first off, I'm jealous of where he is. You know, I walked out this morning and it was just so humid. The humidity is insane down here in Birmingham and he's up in the mountains wearing a sweatshirt, drinking a cup of coffee, you know, just getting ready for a nice little golf round in a couple hours. So that's a little excerpt I'm jealous of. But just overall insight, you know, he was, of course, as plugged in as anyone last week, being sitting next to Dan Hicks and being on such a, you know, an iconic moment in golf history with J.J. Spahn's big putt at 18. So just to get his perspective of, you know, not only that moment, but just what he observed throughout the day and the crazy conditions. I thought he gave great insight. Excuse me.
I'll say I was very jealous myself. I got to spend a few months in Cashers a few years ago, and mountain air up there, it's just one of the best places in the state of North Carolina. There are a lot of them that are in this state. So wish Kiz luck on social media. Member, I think is it member this week at Mountaintop, or was it member guest?
I think member guest is what he said.
Okay. Well, send Kiz some messages of good luck.
Speaking of Ahead with this, like, I know you talk about these trust-based relationships. Seriously, when it comes to these big time events, you really have to have it. There's I know I'm kind of leaning into this a little bit, but seriously, when you're not looking somebody in the eye, I have to have a lot of trust in the fact that they know where I'm going and I know where they're going, and I'm not leading anybody awry, and they're not leading me into a weird place. So it's been a lot of fun working with both of these guys, but especially Kiz. Him and I both have a great rapport as far as just talking golf. And it's been really fun to work with him on the broadcast, and there's no faking, you know, just overall connection with somebody as far as just being able to talk to him. And Kiz and I have a little bit of that. So that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then on Dan, is there any piece of that interview you want to kind of get people ready for?
Well, I mean, Dan's just he's a pro. The pro's pro, you know,
he's as good as it gets.
You know, it's really fun to watch a talent like himself have moments like that to where you can really see, you know, how good he is at what he does. You know, you have these 72 hole tournaments are a long time to call shots, to send it over to holes, to personalize guys. And, you know, that's a career type of moment. And he's been doing this a long time. He's had some incredible calls. When you think about Tiger Woods making that putt in 08, did you expect anything different? And I think just his insight of how he prepares for big moments like that and calls like that and just letting it come to him just shows how natural and gifted he is as a sports broadcaster. And also he's been a great friend and a great mentor to me, to where I've been able to go to him more and more over the years with things on how to improve. But I tell anybody, I've been lucky and fortunate to be at NBC to where I just get better by osmosis, meaning I just get to listen to really talented people. And it's hard not to get better by just listening to their cadences and how they approach talking on air to the viewers. So I've been super blessed. And Dan was great. Kiz was great. It's going to be a great episode.
Yeah, the three of you have an incredible chemistry, both on and off camera. And I think that those are maybe some of my favorite parts of these conversations, is just hearing about what goes on in the booth between shots when you're off camera. And on Dan, I mean, just we're going to hear the call in that interview, but just the how about one? I mean, does it get any better in terms of punctuating one of the greatest moments in U.S. Open history? So I'm not going to waste any more of your time. We're going to get started right here with a Kevin Kisner interview, take a quick break, and get to Dan Hicks. Here we go.
All right, guys, welcome back. Another episode of the Smiley Show. We got the Kiz in the house. Another, I guess, kind of like happy hour. I mean, we do this enough now, Kiz. We're starting to get used to talking to each other. Now we're just doing it on camera this time. But, man, we just had a pretty epic U.S. Open, man. And just instant reactions, man. Just having a day or two just to kind of digress from what we just witnessed.
Yeah, it was a wild day, dude. I never, like, during the broadcast in the booth, I could never really put my finger on what was going on or what was about to happen. Like, you were kind of more in the action. We were talking in commercials a little bit. It was just straight carnage, you know, mostly. And then suddenly after the rain delay, it was like JJ Spahn out of nowhere has come back and is just like the only guy that can hit a quality golf shot for the last hour and a half, 2 hours of the U.S. Open. And I thought the two drives he hit on 17 and 18, like,
so good.
Showed his resolve from the Players' Championship and how he can handle that pressure in that situation. Like, you were watching right there in front of him, and, like, as soon as the ball took off, you're like, and this is striped. And, I mean, it's just incredible that under the biggest situation in his life, he probably made his two best swings. I thought that was a really cool way to come back from getting completely hosed early on in the front nine, and I think it all repaid him when Victor Hovland's ball settled 1 foot behind his ball on the 18th green.
I mean, how many times, kids, have you played in a final group or you're in contention or even seen somebody else, but you know the emotions of what it feels like of showing up on Sunday ready to go. You feel like you had a great range session, and then you get out there and somehow it's like not coming out the middle. You're getting terrible lies. You're getting terrible breaks. You know, JJ Spahn's breaks at one, terrible lies in the rough, and then he hits the flag at two. You've been there. What do you think what was going through JJ Spahn's head through those first six holes where he's five over through six, and all of a sudden, you know, all these dreams you have of winning a major championship feel like they just went out the window and it happened so quick?
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly it can happen. And I know there's no way he wasn't thinking, like, obviously this isn't my day, right? Like, right. It's so easy for that to creep into your head when those things are happening. And I think the reset is such a huge deal for him. You know, I was telling Dan in one of the commercials, like, JJ was kind of out of my picture of winning the U.S. Open when the rain delay happened, right? Like, sure. We weren't even hardly showing him anymore. We weren't coming to you. And, you know, I tell people all the time, like, I hate re-warming up. I don't know if you did when you played, but I hate, like, after a rain delay. Or if I practice a lot in the morning and go eat lunch and then I, like, want to go play, I never can, like, get the feels again. So maybe JJ kind of found some new feels, and Sam and Scotty did not on the re-warm-up. I think the conditions obviously played a huge role in the in this, I call it kind of the second half of the final round. I think guys were hitting squirrely iron shots, trying not to touch the ground with the water. And JJ seemed to manage that the best, but it was a heck of a turnaround. And I thought it was really cool that you got to be in that group to call those last few shots.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the conditions, because every single step that I took walking down these fairways felt like I was walking in a puddle. I mean, the fairways were definitely saturated. And I'm wondering, you know, with if this was a PGA Tour event, Kiz, do you think the overall, you know, committee, do you think they would have sent the guys out, or do you think they would have waited for the golf course to be a little bit more playable? I'm just wondering, from your experience of playing on the PGA Tour for years and years, I mean, it was like 80% casual water in all the fairways.
Pretty sure we would have played the ball up on Sunday on the PGA Tour with the conditions already set and the looming forecast. The PGA Tour does a great job of trying to get the tournament in the time allotted. So it sure is a lot easier to go play in those conditions when you don't have to worry about, is this casual water or not? And we have arguments like Sam did in the 15th fairway. We just move the ball until it's in an area that you feel comfortable with by playing it up. So I don't know what the USGA high horse on not playing the ball up is. I mean, I know they want to play golf as it is, but is it golf if the best players in the world are sculling sand wedges, trying not to touch the ground because it's so saturated, or fatting irons and hitting five irons 30 yards left when you know it's the only place you can't hit it? At some point, the conditions are causing that, and it's not in a good way. Like, I don't mind conditions causing bad shots, but when it's something out of your control, like water in the fairways, and, you know, another thing I was talking about, and every time I play in those conditions, the ball always goes right off the face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But all these guys were hitting it left, and I don't know if they were reacting to trying not to hit it right or what, but every shot for the last hour and a half went left.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to JJ Spahn after his second shot at 12. This is, you know, Jay, we're still not in the JJ Spahn mode at this point, because Sam Burns just made a birdie at 10. And at this point, after he makes birdie at 10, it feels like Sam Burns is probably going to win this golf tournament. It just feels that way after making a big putt at the turn. And then the chaos happens at 11. And then all of a sudden, I'm doing the math. I'm like, JJ Spahn has a chance to win this, and so is Victor. But at the time, JJ hits this huge right ball after taking casual water relief. So it's not like he probably dropped and it still got wet from dropping, because he's still dropping in a wet spot. But JJ walks past me and he says, "Side hill lie, wet ball, pretty sweet, huh?" And I was like, "Yeah, I bet that was pretty tight." I mean, JJ doesn't hit it, you know, if he pushes a shot, it's going to go like 10 to 15 yards right. It's not going to go SK right, you know?
Right.
It's not good. I mean, that's how far right it went. And then he gets that amazing break where he gets on top of that mound. But to your point, I saw everything for the most part go left except for that shot.
Yeah. So, Sam fatted on 11, Scotty scull it, and then Sam's wedge shot on 12 going, I mean, the only place you can't hit the ball on 12 is left of that hole, and he's got a sand wedge in his hand, just puts it in a terrible spot. Actually hit an unbelievable chip, but then missed the putt. And I think that's when he kind of got rattled at that point. Like, 11 happened, and now he thinks he's about to get one back on 12, and he makes 6. And it's like, man, maybe I'm not going to win this tournament.
I mean, what's going through your head as a competitor, that's anybody other than JJ Spahn, right? So JJ Spahn makes, you know, that 40 footer at 12. He makes a 22 footer at 14. Then he makes a 65 footer at 18. I know those last four guys we're talking about, with Spahn, Hovland, Adam Scott, Sam Burns, those are the four guys who we thought were going to win the golf tournament heading into the day. When you see all that kind of happening as a player, do you just tip your cap to the guy that just finds a way to get it done? Or are you just like, man, that just seems crazy to me how somebody can make that many feet of putts in 6 holes on the back nine of a U.S. Open?
Yeah, I think you tip your cap and you kind of understand it's his time, right? Like, you know, those things happen to you or I when we're playing, and we like love it and don't think about how lucky we are. We just expect it. But as you're watching from the outside, it's like, dude, you could have a small bucket back there and never make that putt on 18. So it's your time. And, you know, I think, like I said, it's kind of making up for what happened early on in the round. And like a lot of people say, it all works out over time. And it worked out for JJ. You know, he made more feet of putts in the last 6 holes than some people make in a whole tournament. So
exactly.
He definitely deserved it. And I think you tip your cap and realize that, you know, it's his time.
All right. So when he makes that putt at 18, I know you probably had maybe seen that putt a time or two during the day. Of course, we just saw Victor make the putt. But what were your percentages as far as what you thought JJ's chances were to just two putt? Because I tried to tee it up the best I could that I thought it was a hard lag putt.
Yeah, you know how we are in the booth. We're like scribbling notes back and forth to each other while we're on the air. And basically Terry Gannon, in fact, said put up like 50-50 on two putt, right? And then, you know, I'd seen that putt probably 10 times throughout the day. And most guys were getting it within 4 or 5 feet. It wasn't like it was impossible to get to a makeable second. But I kind of could – we had the same camera angle on everybody's putt. So I could kind of tell when it crested the ridge whether the speed was good or not. Mm-hmm. And so Dan is kind of leading as it's rolling, like, you know, needs a two-putt to win the U.S. Open. And it crested the hill. And I'm like, oh, man, this is perfect speed. Like, it's not going – it's a two-putt, right? And I just stick my thumb up right in front of Dan's face like, it's good.
Yeah.
And because I know he's got to make some crazy big moment right there if it does something good. And nobody in that booth was thinking this putt's going in, right? You're not thinking it. No one in America's thinking it. And so I'm like, what is Dad going to say if it goes in as it's rolling and hits the pin? And he goes, how about one? And I thought that was the coolest call ever. So, kudos to Dan for being out. That's why he's so good at what he does, and he filled in perfectly in that spot. I would have been like, what just happened, you know, on air.
Isn't it incredible watching him go after that?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible to see that he can just roll with it and know the situation, and that's why he's such a good guy at that. But, yeah, I would say 50-50 on three-putt is what we were guessing in the booth.
I wanted to see like the inside cam reaction of all four of you guys after the putt went in. I just wanted to see you guys just, you know, stand up and just try to keep your composure knowing that Dan's got this call. But at the same time, you probably just witnessed one of the most, I don't know if there's going to be anything that ever tops it on an 18 green for a long time for a major championship. The one that comes to mind for me is the 2008 on Torrey Pines with Tiger Woods, the putt he had to make. But golly, I mean, where does this stack up for you?
Dude, it's got to be at the top for me. Like, to win the first major, win the U.S. Open, like, I don't even know exact footage of the putt, but it had to be over 60 feet. And it went in like a two-footer, dude. It was like perfect speed, dead middle. I mean, it's just incredible to me that, you know, when you saw it, I saw another angle from the other side of the hole, and I know you were talking it up about how hard the putt was, but it breaks a lot late.
Oh, God, yeah.
And, I mean, it was out there like 6 feet left of the hole at one point, and I'm like, how did he know this is going in? But, I mean, it went in. It would have gone in a thimble. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, Tiger's was incredible, and we see that putt roll how many times, and it's bouncing all over the place and goes in. But, you know, situationally, knowing what JJ was trying to accomplish in his first major championship, I think it's probably top of the list.
Well, I was listening to the conversation that JJ had post-golf tournament, talking a little about something that him and Max Homer were talking about that I guess Max learned from Tiger, that said that, hey, dude, U.S. Opens, you basically just try to hang around on the back nine. And even when you think you're out of it, still just hang in there. That goes for probably very few amount of events, kids. Like when you think about winning on the PGA Tour and what you have to do, you can't take a couple holes off and expect to win a golf tournament on the PGA Tour. But when it comes to a U.S. Open and a very difficult golf course like this, how do you go into that with the correct mindset to be able to come out the champion? Because very few are able to win major championships, and it does take a little luck at times, but also just hanging in there sometimes is the best formula for majors.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think the start probably helped JJ's mindset the most. Kind of like, man, maybe, you know, it's not my day. I'm, you know, six back or whatever he was after four holes, and he settled in, started making some pars, and I think his mindset probably changed to, you know, let's just try to get as good a finish as we can.
Right.
And then he starts making birdies, and it's like, oh, crap, I might be able to win this tournament. So I think that change in the attitude and the mindset throughout the round probably helped him being his first major, and probably put the most pressure on Adam and Sam, because they're like, hey, it's our tournament to win or lose, which is the heaviest burden you can have playing in the last group of a major. So those two situations, I think, were super helpful. But to your point, a PGA Tour event, you know, if you're two shots up with six to go, you better birdie 2 to 3 out of the last six to win the golf tournament.
Sure.
U.S. Open, it's like, man, I might be able to bogey 2 out of the last six and win the golf tournament.
Exactly.
So that mindset only comes around once or twice a year, and it's so different. And I think where JJ was when he started making birdies and hanging in there was such a good situation for him.
Well, you probably got a little bit of sense of where the guys were, you know, heading into Sunday. I think one of my favorite things that you do is you go get treatment from your trainer at golf tournaments, even if you're working the broadcast. Like, hey, you want to go, whether it's eat breakfast or lunch, like, nah, I'm heading to the golf course to get treatment done. And I think that's awesome. But still, did you happen to run into any of those top four guys that morning just getting a sense of kind of where they stood?
Well, to be honest, I kind of selfishly do it to make myself feel better, but that's where they all go before they tee off.
Sure.
So it's a little more casual area because nobody comes in there like the locker room where all the caddies come and teachers and, you know, this locker room used to be this sacred room, but now everybody has access to it, it seems like. But the treatment room is just you and the trainers and everybody seems to be more off the cuff. And what I've learned since TV is if I hang out in there, you know, guys just kind of let it loose a little bit more. And I saw Adam Scott that morning, and he seemed a little uptight about the whole situation. I did not see JJ or Sam, but just kind of walked around on the range, and I could tell JJ was super tight on the putting green that morning. Like, you know, he missed some short putts grinding with his team on the putting green, and you could kind of tell it affected him, which, you know, heck, it would affect all of us. You know, I've never won a major. You never won a major. But if you're out there with a chance and you're like missing putts on the putting green, you're like, oh, my God, what if I miss that on the course type of stuff? And Sam seemed the most chill, like by far. He's out there chilling with his guys and, you know, doing his routine. And I was like, man, Sam's in a really good spot. It's going to be a tough one to track him down if he gets off to a good start. But it just, you know, they both shot 3 over on the front, I think, and still winning the golf tournament. That tells you how hard the conditions were.
I mean, there's so many storylines kind of unfolding at this U.S. Open. Did any player stand out? And of course, JJ Spahn, we talked about him, but did any other player kind of stand out that kind of rose to the occasion this week? Or do you think it was more so Oakmont won?
Well, I'm super interested by like a guy like John Rahm, who we didn't really talk about or have a chance. And suddenly on Sunday, shoots 67 and posts 4 over. And all we talk about for an hour and a half is like, maybe 4 over wins the golf tournament at this point. Who knows?
Dude, if Scotty would have somehow backdoored this thing too, he's another guy.
I kept slapping Dan like, dude, if he made any of those putts on the back nine, you know, he posts 1 or 2 over. And I don't know if guys changed their mindset to that, but as bad as we thought Scotty was playing, he's playing terrible or not, you know, not going to have a chance. Suddenly, like 2 hours left in his round, I'm like, dude, if he posts 3 under on the back nine somehow, he wins this golf tournament. and then Bobby McIntyre, like what a couple shots he hit coming down the stretch for a chance to win. And I love his vibe about golf. Like, you know, please God be right or whatever he said on 17 when he touched that driver. I thought that was really cool. Like he's living in the moment. He's trying to win. And so those two guys are, you know, three guys stood out to me.
All right. So your assistant captain, of course, for the Ryder Cup coming up at Bethpage. Seems like JJ Spahn all but just locked up his spot based off of points. And I think it's kind of thrown a whole wrench a little bit into the American team because if JJ doesn't win that tournament, you expect he's going to be in the category of needing a pick. All of a sudden, he's a guy that might be locked up based off of points. I'm not sure how close it is yet, but still, Kiz, you have to feel like this might light a fire into some players that are on the bubble.
Yeah, we need them to, you know. We need some guys that have had experience in Ryder Cups to come rise to the top now, you know. If JJ's on the team for sure, you got guys like Ben Griffin and Andrew Novak right there. You know, they have another couple good weeks. They could lock it up.
Sure.
And they'll be all rookies at a Ryder Cup in New York. So we need some veterans to step up to the plate and be able to be mentors to these guys at this tournament. You know, it's the biggest team event that we could possibly have, and we need as much experience as we possibly have. But I'm not worried about guys like JJ Spahn. I love his game, and I'll put him under my arm and get him fired up to go play. You just got to be careful who you pair the rookies with and make sure they feel comfortable in those situations to go shine and show the world why they're on the team.
It doesn't feel a little odd this year because the team was so seemed like set, like at Whistling Straits and even closer to Rome, maybe a little bit of a disarray. But this year just seems – a bit of everything. You have all of these first timers for Ryder Cups. I can think of about 6 to 7 guys that legitimately have a good chance to make the team. And then you have plenty of these veteran guys that I would say are, you know, they need to play well. And it's going to be tough for Keegan to call one of these rookies to tell them they're not on the team when they've played better than the veterans this year. So that's my whole question is how much experience do you think is needed on this team? And can you roll out a team that's just really playing well that maybe has a little bit more rookies?
Well, kind of our, you know, what we talk about is we want as much experience as we can get, but not if your game's not there. You know, you look at a guy like Brooks Koepka. Yeah, from the time I was asked to be a vice captain, I never really thought that he wouldn't be on our team, right? But he hasn't played great, so it's just this is me speaking to not Keegan, but I'm like, dude, you if you're not playing good, you can't be on it. Help us, even if you're experienced. If you're shooting 4 over, it doesn't really help us. Now, he played better at the U.S. Open, but I need him to show me he's playing great before we could make a choice to pick him, right? So it's a hard conundrum that you're in. Like, you want experience, but you also can't take a guy that's not showing form. And, I you know, I'm not trying to get too ahead of that form right sure. now. We still have one more major, and then we have the 3 playoff events that a lot of guys can show us some form. And I think it's a really fun and exciting process to be a part of. I'm glad that I'm on the side, and hopefully it'll all work out, and we'll have a great Ryder Cup for the United States.
Yeah, I guess the one thing I want to ask you here about Keegan is I just want to put you in his shoes for a guy who I think is easily a top 12 American player right now. Do you think he has more or less pressure with his game right now as far as just his wants and will to want to be on this team based off of points? Do you think it frees him up to know that, hey, I don't really care to be on the team, but I also know that I would love to be on the team if I play good enough? Where do you think Keegan's golf brain is right now with kind of where he sits in this whole Ryder Cup standing stuff?
I think Keegan's so focused on being the captain of the Ryder Cup that his game's kind of secondary to that. Like, I don't think he tees up thinking, I want to make the Ryder Cup as much as a guy like Ben Griffin does. Does right. that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Tees it up on Thursday at the Travelers, he's trying to win a golf tournament, but he's also thinking about, man, how are we going to handle that dinner on Thursday night, or what are we going to do Friday morning type of stuff? You know, if he shows up and wins this week or wins the British Open, I think Keegan's mindset will change to more player-centric on the Ryder Cup. But basically, it's going to be up to Keegan, you know? I can't tell Keegan he has to play on the team if he doesn't want to play, right? If he makes the team, obviously, that's great. But I don't think anyone can tell Keegan, hey, we're picking you, except Keegan saying, I want to play, and I think I'm deserving. So that'll all unfold in time. But as of right now, he's playing great, and we could use his assets on the team.
Well, I'm going to miss working with you at the Ryder Cup, man. We were losing you and Woody that week, so it's going to be a couple man down that week.
I know. How many times do you think Tommy or somebody's going to text me, hey, can you hop on with Smiley real quick or whatever? I mean, my phone's going to be blowing up from Tommy. And I really enjoy TV. I love working with you. I think you and I have a great camaraderie back and forth as it unfolds the whole play. But you can't pass up a dream opportunity like sure. what I have at the Ryder Cup. And if everything works out, you and I have plenty of Ryder Cups to call in our lifetime.
And let me ask you this. How many people think that you and I look alike?
Man, it's my favorite thing in the world. And Charlie's going to laugh at this, but every time I'm walking through an airport or at a golf tournament and somebody goes, oh, Smiley, what's up? And I always tell him to F off just so Smiley gets a bad rap everywhere he goes. It's awesome. I even told Smiley's dad that in the hotel this week, and he started laughing so hard. It was awesome. He's like, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. I was like, yes, great. When they call me Smiley, I go straight to the F word.
Oh, man. Well, what a U.S. Open in Oakmont, kids. Keep on doing your thing, man. Where are you playing next?
I'm playing next week in Detroit John Deere, then coming to see you at the British Open. We're going to play some Twilight Golf together.
Yes,
the British
we are.
Open. Bring your weapons.
Yes, indeed. All right, buddy. Well, best of luck in Detroit. See you at the Open and get all those kids dialed in. Wait, it's member guest this weekend, right, too?
Yes, sir. Practice round in 3 hours. So don't call me unless you need some alcohol-infused kids in your life.
All right, buddy. Have a good one, man. Thanks, kids.
All right. Thanks for having me, man.
Hope you enjoyed that Kevin Kisner conversation. Golly, I think this is his third time on the show, and it never gets old. And it's never not entertaining.
Well, I appreciate him coming on. You know, it's I know he's got a little bit more media in him now, but still to take the time. I know he's up there on vacation playing some golf. So taking the morning out for a very busy schedule that he's had this year. Probably one of the busiest men in golf, with as much golf as he played and doing media and being a father and TGL. It's been a busy year for him. So we appreciate him taking the time.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll say too, these two guys, some pretty good golf they have on deck this weekend. If you had the distinct privilege or pleasure of taking your golf clubs from Mountaintop in Cassius, North Carolina, up to Wingfoot, one way you could do it is by using Shift Sticks.
You probably wouldn't need to be honest.
You probably wouldn't need to. Yeah, depending, you probably have to go to the Asheville Airport. I'm not sure where you fly into, you know, on Long Island for Wingfoot, but Shift Sticks gets you from your front door to four easier than ever. They'll pick up your golf clubs from your home or office, or maybe your mountain cabin, and deliver them on time, guaranteed to your golf destination anywhere in and outside the United States. No more airport headaches, no more lugging heavy bags, just easy, stress-free travel for golfers like you. Supporting benefits include white glove service, complimentary insurance, real-time tracking, door-to-door service, international shipping, and it's for any occasion. Shift Sticks is perfect for buddies trips, business trips, even family vacations where managing kids, strollers, and extra luggage can ruin your vacation before it's even begun. And maybe also members and member guests at two very top-tier clubs.
My agent doesn't even ever take his clubs to the airport. He just uses Shift Sticks. That is his way to get golf clubs from his house to the golf course. I mean, seriously, swears by it. He'd say it's unbelievable. I've used it before, of course, but for the most part, I'll bring my clubs with me to the airport. But I mean, it's becoming for a lot of city people, it seems like a lot of city people really lean into not wanting to deal with, you know, whether they're getting on the subway to get to the airport. I don't know how New York people get anywhere, but if they get there by a train, subway, whatever it is, or car, it seems like that's way, way easier.
Yeah, I mean, why would you do anything else? It's just one less thing to worry about. And if you are a city person, if you're a mountain person, wherever you are, however you're going to play golf at a different location, you can enjoy 20% off your next shipment by using the promo code SMILEY. That's SMYLIE. And we'll, of course, put a link in the podcast and YouTube that you can use to ship your clubs wherever you're going next.
Have I told you the time that I accidentally hopped on a private flight and left my clubs in the taxi car?
This, you have not. This is, I like the beginnings of the story.
This is how Shift Sticks was first used for me. We were going from the Northern Trust to the Deutsche Bank, 2016. Ooh. We're playing out in the Hamptons, hopped on a flight. We get in Boston. My clubs are not in the plane. And somehow the clubs didn't make it from the taxi cab to the plane. So watch out, flying private sometimes can be very difficult.
I heard a story about this. I think it was Claire Rogers who had a story on this at Erin Hills a couple weekends ago, where there was some situation with, I believe it was Amari Avery, where they had to move Airbnbs or move hotels or something. And her, I don't know if it's her boyfriend or fiance or husband, he had to leave for the airport and took her clubs with him to the airport. Yeah. So, I mean, there are so many stories about, you know, golf clubs trying to travel horror stories. It's one less thing to worry about. Just use Shift Sticks, get them there on time, ride the clubhouse, walk up. There they are at the bag drop. So we appreciate Shift Sticks for presenting this episode. And without further ado, we're going to get to Dan Hicks for more breakdown on the 125th U.S. Open.
All right, welcome back. Another episode of The Smiley Show. And of course, just had Kevin Kisner on, and now we have Dan Hicks on the show. So Dan, I know this may feel a little bit about, you know, a little happy hour-ish here, and I'm happy to have you on as a guest, my man.
Very much so. Good to be on. And the only other time I was on, we were live at the Pinecrest Inn at the U.S. Open last year at Pinehurst. So that was on site. That was a live version there.
Sure was.
Good to be back on. Your background looks great. It's a little different than Oakmont.
It definitely is. This was my grandfather's. This sat above his mantle in his den. So it's one of my favorite photos ever, or paintings, I should say. And reminds me of him, but it also reminds me of the West Coast. And I just love that whole area. All right, Danny, we've had plenty of you know, U.S. Opens over the year that have had earned nicknames. You know, you could think of the meltdown at Wingfoot in 06. You could think of the Tigers' Torrey triumph in 08, and maybe even Wingfoot, where you remember at Bryson's Blueprint, where he kind of defied the USGA distance and how you're supposed to strategize around a golf course. And then maybe this year, I don't know what you think, but JJ responds at Oakmont.
I could tell you put a lot of thought into that, Smiley.
What do you think?
Off the top of my head, I can't beat that because that's exactly what it was. That was one of the most, I think I said it in the aftermath of the chaos of JJ Spahn dancing around with his caddy, Mark Cairns, in the rain with an umbrella. I said something like, in one of the wildest U.S. Open championship Sundays we've ever seen. Because that's exactly what it was. I mean, that was my 26th U.S. Open, which is crazy. Just when you think you've seen it all, you haven't, and you see something. You see something that happened with JJ Spahn. You know, we'll never see something like that again. We'll never see a 65-foot putt or 64 feet 5 inches, however it exactly was, to win the U.S. Open. I guarantee it. In another 26 U.S. Opens, you won't see it happen quite like it happened on Sunday.
Well, let's just talk about, you know, this being your 26th U.S. Open as a play-by-play voice for NBC. You know, what does that milestone mean for you, Dan? And, you know, it's I'm sure it's been quite the journey from, you know, Oakmont to your first one at Shinnecock.
Yeah, first, the one word that comes to mind, Smiley, is privilege, because you never know, how long you're going to be able to do them. Your network, in this case NBC, has to have the rights to do them. So you've got to be lucky to be able to have the opportunity to do them, and then just to be able to stay in that chair and work with all the greats that I've had the pleasure to work with, from Johnny to Zing to now Kiz and company, and Fax is up there. Believe me, I never take it for granted. Although I will say, Friday's second round of this year, I want to get your take on this. It seemed a little slow. Mm-hmm. We got off the show on Friday and the guys were getting beat up on the course, and it just felt like, is this one going to deliver? And then I remember telling, I don't know if it was Gil Capps or Mike Tirico or somebody, I said, you know, sometimes we have that feeling, and then Sunday, who knows what's going to happen. So it certainly turned around to one of the great, great finishes in U.S. Open history in a hurry.
You know what that void you were missing was on Friday? It was just happy hour. That's all it was.
You know, I knew there was something.
You had this itch and you're just trying to scratch it. You didn't know what it was.
That there was no happy hour on Friday. If a U.S. Open ever needed a happy hour on Friday, that was the one. Uh-huh. We could have used it just to get away from the bludgeoning on the course, because it was getting beat up. But that's the U.S. Open, right? I mean, this putt for bogey, this putt for par. That's what it's all about.
You know, we had so many storylines heading into that Sunday where it really kind of rounded into form, where we've had this final four feeling heading into Sunday with all these unique storylines. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, through, I guess, even right around the rain delay, you have all of these exploding possibilities of who could win this golf tournament from the four that we had at the beginning of the day. So from your seat, Dan, what's going through your mind when it kind of turns into this kind of wide open free for all?
I looked up and all of a sudden there's five guys tied for the lead. I thought, how in the hell did we end up here? It happened like in a blink of an eye. I think I used that term on the telecast. So, you know, there was so many twists and turns, and then all of a sudden to have it come down to, and then there was Rahm sitting in there at plus four. I know a lot of people probably thought that was still far-fetched, but I kept pointing out that score because guys were going backwards. They were sliding down the hill just like some of the fans in the mud at Oakmont. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was going the other way. And then when Scheffler was trying to get in there, he didn't quite get to the plus four number. So I thought those guys had a chance at the time, because that's how the golf course was played. So you even had those guys in the outside looking in, and then all these guys tied for the lead. But that's what you hope for. That's what you dream for, that you've got all those possibilities. And, you know, we had just played the Tiger Woods 2008, look back at Torrey Pines, and I'm thinking, are we setting the stage for something, similar craziness that we just saw? So anyway, it was it turned into something in the blink of an eye that was just one of the all timers. Really,
it really was, and it was a little bit of a different type of chaos. Maybe you can kind of compare it to Wingfoot in 2006 when the storyline that entire day is Phil Mickelson. Can he go and win his first U.S. Open? And from your chair again, when you're kind of selling this narrative and this storyline of Phil Mickelson going and winning this, and all of a sudden, in a blink of an eye, Jeff Ogilvy is the U.S. Open champion. Now, how do you, you know, keep yourself composed knowing that it can change in a blink of an eye and all of a sudden this buildup that you've been having has to change just like that? And this week was almost a Robert McIntyre situation.
Yes. I think a lot of people, including us, and I think the interview that Robert McIntyre did at the end after J.J. Spahn was still on the course that he did with Cara Banks, I mean, if you played that back, you'd be like, that guy won the U.S. Open. I can tell. And I think in his heart of hearts, he thought he'd won it. And that's what made it so crazy when he watched from scoring that putt by J.J. Spahn go in. And a great act of sportsmanship, right? He sits back and he gives it one of these. This thing had so much going on. It had, every time I see that putt, I think of the rain coming down, the umbrellas. It was kind of one of those almost movie-like atmospheres that you just don't get. I mean, sun could have been shining and that would have been great, but I think it even added to the moment with the rain coming down and the umbrella and Karen's and JJ Spahn spinning around. I just thought it was incredible. It's one of those deals where when it spins like that, You gotta pivot. And, the possibility of J.J. Spahn still winning was there, but I was doing a real deep dive into Robert McIntyre. And we found out that the Silver Scott Tommy Armour won the first Open at U.S. Open at Oakmont. So we had a nice little, parallel going there, but it switched in a hurry.
Yeah, it has to kind of screw up your prep a little bit. I'm sure most of the stuff you did the night before was getting ready for those four guys. I know you got to be prepared for anything, but I'm sure you and Gil were kind of trying to figure out, all right, I need to get some info on this guy quick.
Yeah, I Sam Burns had the one shot lead, and I had a feeling he was going to play strong, and he did. And so what I try to do the night before, actually, this was the day of, the morning of, I got on the phone with Brett, his agent, Sam Burns' agent, and I said, hey, listen, we know Sam a little bit, but just give me anything you have that maybe would kind of, get his personality out there a little bit, something that the viewers would like to hear. So I had a nice conversation with Brett. So I had a bunch of stuff ready for Sam Burns that never quite materialized, which kind of went down the drain, no pun intended, at 15 when he double bogeyed that hole and we had the ruling. That's what I try to do. I try to do as much as I can beforehand, but then in the end, which makes this business so good and so cool, is that you never know what's going to happen. And it did a JJ Spahn is not going to win this thing. No way to wait a minute. We got five guys. Wait a minute. It's JJ Spahn and Robert McIntyre. And oh my God, JJ Spahn is the U.S. Open champion. It seemed like it happened in a matter of minutes.
It was quick, and you got to give a lot of credit to our team at NBC, Tommy Roy leading the charge. You and I both know what it's like, how much goes into a live broadcast and making sure it matches the storylines of what's happening during a crazy Sunday. So
by the way, Smiley, speaking of that, I'll just, not to plug or kiss our producers, but those replays that you saw, like, right after they went in, you've got in the director, Joe Martin, let's give him his due as well. I mean, those happened like boom, boom. Like it goes it goes back to Spahn. It goes back to Josh Gregory's shot. I mean, that was all in real time at the time of the live broadcast. You got Josh Gregory. We had just told the story about how he turned his short game around by working with Josh. So Tommy Roy, Joe Martin, those guys have the wherewithal to get all those shots amid all the chaos. Like, oh my God, who's important? Well, you go Spahn's caddy, you go Melody and the two girls, Josh Gregory, you go fans, you go wide, and then you just do it again from all these different angles. So They absolutely delivered, and that's the brilliance of Tommy Roy.
Oh, this is the perfect time, Dan, to tee up your call. It was an incredible call, and we got Charlie in here with the sound, so we're going to listen to it, and then we're going to react to it after. So, Charlie, if you don't mind, let's listen to that call on the 18th green from Dan Hicks.
Want to cozy it up. Don't need to make it. Two putts.
I mean, that golf ball, without seeing the picture, that was rolling for a very long time.
It was. And we're all – so the only regret that I think Tommy Roy, just talked to him a short time after the show, he said, he goes, the only regret we didn't that we wish we would have done is the replay of the booth. You know how they've got a camera on us?
Yes.
So it's Terry Gannon, Brad Faxon, Kiz, and me. And I don't know what I did. All I did was reach a new decibel level of, how about one? That's just the first thing that came into my mind. But I guess Kiz and Fax and T. Gannon went crazy too. So don't be surprised if you see the replay of that at the Open Championship at Royal Portrush when we see JJ's bomb. Because I guess the old booth lost control a little bit as well there. But that we couldn't contain ourselves. We've never seen anything like that.
Well, it was an incredible call, Dan. And I was going to ask you this. So, you know, when we're kind of setting up this putt from JJ Spahn, of course, we watch Victor Hovland just putt right before. But, you know, it's my job to let you guys know, hey, this is not an easy two putt. And so after, you know, I kind of lay out, let the thing breathe, let you do your thing, Dan. And JJ hits this putt while it's rolling. Of course, like in your mind, you're probably preparing for, you're not thinking about it going in, right? Like that's not even coming into your mind thinking about I going to say if this goes in? You're probably just thinking about, you know, if it goes to 6 feet, what you're going to say, or if it goes to tap in, what you might say going in. Like, so that coming out in real time was just incredible. What a call.
That's the biggest example, Smiley, of not getting ahead of yourself and not getting start scripting things before they happen, because that obviously things were kind of going through my mind. He's going to cozy it up there like I thought he was. And so then now we're going to get ready for a little tap in putt, or maybe it was going to be a 4 footer. Who knows? There was all these possibilities. But that's the biggest example why you don't get ahead of yourself, because it was in the moment. I was just watching it. You've got to react to what you're seeing. You've got to stay locked into what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. And I had just said the last words out of my mouth were two putts. So that was kind of, and it just kind of strung together. And I just hooked it on and just said, oh, how about one? So that was like, you know, it was just having a natural conversation at a little more of a high energy level. But it was just kind of keeping in the moment, two putts, cozy it up, and then just kind of string it on, how about one? So that's a big example of why you don't get ahead of yourself and script things out and just kind of let the moments happen when they do.
So we just had Kiz on, and he said that while the putt was rolling, he had seen that putt maybe a couple times during the day, to where he knew when it kind of crested over the hill. At that point, you still couldn't see the flagstick, but he felt like it was going to be a good putt. And he said this is what he did. I don't know if you saw it, but he said he put his thumb up and he said, this is going to be good. Like thumbs up to you, knowing that, hey, this is going to be a good putt.
Yeah.
Did you see his thumb?
I don't think I did.
I can't imagine why.
I was locked in on the monitor and just making sure I didn't screw this epic US Open moment up. But afterwards, I do remember Kiz saying, man, I knew that was like, I had a good chance if I go in. I thought, you know, but I did not see the thumbs up. You know what we'll do is we'll look back at the tape that I talked about and try to see that.
Yeah, let's see the thumbs up.
We'll have the.
You're probably doing this. You're probably like, yeah.
Get out of here, Kiz. You know how it was. Kiz, that'll be enough of you for now. Let me do the call. Thank you very much. But so we'll have to get the evidence and see if we can grab the thumbs up from Kiz on the talent camera, as they call it.
I mean, it was epic.
Smiley, you were. People don't know how hard your job is. The guys on the ground. I mean, first of all, you're slopping around in mud for hours and hours and hours. That's just a physical test. And people say, oh, well, he's young and he's fine and it's blah, blah, blah. Everybody like to do it. think again, because you're not only trying to get yourself in the right position up and down slopes of muddy, where you can, you know, I want to ask you how many times you probably almost lost your footing on the side of those.
Oh,
because you're
man.
Hustling. You're in the moment. You got to get to the next hole. You got to get in position. But people have no idea how hard that job is. And you did an incredible job.
Thank all you, week long.
You were back in the booth for your own little happy hour after after soldiering around the
golf cart. I can't. So, it was a sauna on Friday. I get that coat and tie on. I'm just like, oh.
Smiley would come in and he would look like, you know, I don't know. We had some fun with Smiley because he came in and he was all of a sudden, I've got a coat and tie on and I'm absolutely steamy. The temperature inside of this shirt is 180 and the humidity is higher than.
And it was, we're coming on camera.
Yeah. 3, 2, 1. Anyway,
Danny, thank you, man. It definitely is a bit of an Energizer Bunny type of job when you're an on-course reporter, especially when you legitimately need to check every single lie of any golf ball at this property, because it was such an important part of the story. Is, you know, I kept on hearing the group behind me with Bones, Adam Scott, horrible lie, and then every lie that JJ had after the restart, good lie. I'm telling you, it was
really,
it was a run of luck that I hadn't seen the entire week. He was able to play from every single lie. He got just the just enough of a break on his bad lies to be able to do something with it. And I've always said with major championships that sure, the guy who plays the best for the most part wins most of the time, but you have to have the opportunity to win. You got to put yourself in position. And then you also have this little category too that I think comes into play, which is luck. You need a little bit of luck to win these things. There's no doubt JJ Spahn had a little luck with his lies over the last 9 holes of this golf tournament. And then he also had a little bit of luck and fortune in taking advantage of an opportunity. Who makes 126 feet of putts in 6 holes on a Sunday? I mean, just the most insane thing. So like he's getting a little lucky, taking advantage of that luck. And you got to give the credit to the guy, man. It's just incredible to see a first timer go and do that.
But here's the deal. He was owed it, right? I mean, those bad breaks.
It was bad.
Bounced off the stick on two. And what had happened subsequently, and sometimes when we look back at the telecast, you kind of, there's a lot of times that I'm like, ah, I wish I would have known that. I wish I would have known that JJ Spahn was bouncing the CVS's at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
to get his daughter some medicine, up all night throwing up. Can you imagine? You know, one shot off the lead in the U.S. Open. But that's what you do, you know, and the fact that it was Father's Day and JJ Spahn is like
being a father
is being a father at 3 o'clock in the morning. And oh, by the way, I've got a U.S. Open to try to tackle on the toughest golf course ever. But yeah, I just, you know, and he kind of said that maybe a slow start had something to do with that. And then the rain delay kind of reset him and everything. But that was that's just another part of the story that JJ Spahn wrote.
Well, it was incredible for watching JJ Spahn get it done. And Dan, you not only had Kevin Kisner sitting next to you this week, but you also had your old pal Johnny Miller back sitting next to you for a segment. I know you've spent many, many years calling some big time golf with Johnny Miller, and of course he's a legend, and one of the best to ever do it in that analyst chair. What was it like having him back at Oakmont at a place where he had a Sunday 63 and I'm sure a lot of memories?
It was awesome. And that, of course, will be the last time I see Johnny at Oakmont, unless something crazy happens, because, you know, so it was really cool to see him, really cool to get him on the air and just kind of, you know, shoot the breeze with him a little bit. And, you know, it's not that I forget how good he was, but it was funny because we were running that Tiger Woods 2008 rerun during the rain delay, and just hearing him again, mm-hmm. just pounded into my head how good he was and is. He just had an incredible natural kind of savant crystal ball in everything that he talked about. And so he really put us on the map, Smiley. Long time before the Smiley Kaufman happy hour was the big hit of NBC Golf, Johnny Miller was putting us on the map. I mean, when we got the USGA rights in 1995, we hadn't done much golf at all. It had been a long time. ABC had the rights for a long time to the U.S. Open. We had never done the Open Championship, which we do now. So I credit Johnny Miller to really giving us instant credibility. The USGA, you know, loved Johnny. Of course, he was a big part of their history. He won a junior boys, you know, won the junior championship as well, in addition to his U.S. Open. So He really, you know, really put us on the map and gave all of us, I think,
sure,
the opportunity to do what we do still to this day.
Well, I think he understood the assignment better than anybody. You know, he didn't cheat the viewer. You know, his job was to report his opinion to the viewer, and he put his relationships aside for maybe players that he had respect for, but that's the job. It's giving your opinion and not sugarcoating it. And as a kid, I thought it was too harsh. I was never really a Johnny Miller fan. I thought he was too mean. But I think now, when I got into TV, I have much more respect for him, because guess what? That's what the viewer wants to hear. They want to hear what's going on in the player's mind, and they don't want it to be told any way other than the truth.
Your first responsibility, and you've learned it in a hurry, and I'm sure you had some uneasy moments when you were like, do I say this? That's my buddy, man. We grinded on tour together for all those years, and now I'm going to like kind of call him out on something. But that's what your responsibility is. And the sooner a broadcaster who goes from the field, whatever sport it is, to the broadcast booth figures out that he or she is broadcasting for the people at home, the sooner they figure that out, the quicker they can become the best broadcaster they can be. And it didn't take Johnny long to figure that out.
No, it didn't.
He was ready to pounce, and he'll be the first to say he could have said things in a different manner at times. A lot of times it's the way you say it that you can kind of still be getting the same point across. But Johnny could come across very harsh, and there were some moments where I would basically let about 10 seconds of dead air go by and go, let's go to 17 and Gary Cook, because I had nothing to say. I was like, there's nothing I can say that'll cushion that or, it was just one of those times. Well, he was a blast. You never knew what he was going to say every show.
All right. You got to be honest with me here. How many times would Johnny Miller hit the cheese whiz? Well, and how many times would you hit the cheese whiz too?
You know what? I never partook in the cheese whiz. That was Johnny's thing. It was kind of actually gross to see him.
Oh, you don't say.
Because he was. So first it started off, Kathy Nose, our lovely, brilliant stage manager, would like take the cheese whiz and put it on crackers. And then Johnny would start eating it. And he found that he really liked it so much that he started mainlining it from the nozzle to his mouth. Like I'd hear this like, and I'd be like, what is going on? And Johnny has the nozzle of the cheese whiz and he's direct hitting his mouth with the cheese whiz. So it just kind of became one of his things. And I would look over him and he'd have this smile on his face. I go, what are you doing, dude? You're like, that's not good for you. And he'd have his shoes off, his feet up. You know, he was California, Northern California cool in every way. But the cheese whiz thing was a little disturbing at that.
Oh, when you signed off with Johnny at Oakmont, how do you not both have a tub of cheese whiz and just,
you know what?
Just
we should have.
On the way to break.
These are the kinds of production ideas that only come from the Smiley Kaufman Show. Had I to do it over again, we would have done that. And I would have said, Johnny, just for old time's sake, hand him the cheese whiz can one more time at Oakmont. It would have been perfect.
Oh, damn. That's cinema, Dan. That's cinema.
Absolute cinema. You got it.
Well, I know you've seen plenty of U.S. Open venues in your years, Dan. You know, we go all the way back to, was it 1992?
Five? Shinnecock was our first U.S. Open. Yeah.
1995 Shinnecock. All right. So you've seen plenty of venues over the years for U.S. Opens. Do you have any personal favorites or just from a broadcast perspective or just, just being a fan of the game of some of these venues?
My all-time favorite course and U.S. Open course, doesn't matter, is Shinnecock. Ah, I just think that place is so good. And, doing that first one in 95 just kind of turned me on to the place, and then watching it through the years and living in the area as I do. I've been out there, played golf, got beat up on it. And it's like, you know, it's in National Golf Links is right next door, which is a fabulous place, but that's the happy golf. And then Shinnecock, you go like get your butt kicked for four and a half hours. Sure. I just think Shinnecock has everything you want in a championship course. Cannot wait to get back there next year.
When it's
staged there again. Oh, Smiley.
You drove past it.
Oh man. You are gonna just mark my words, you're gonna fall in love with this place. I'm gonna be interested. You should try to play it before you go out there and the circus comes to town, you know. Yeah. So come on up here, visit me. We'll do a little Wingfoot, little Shinnecock double-double. Or maybe we'll just hang out there and do Shinnecock National. That's the perfect day.
Little Johnny Walker Black to end the day, maybe?
Maybe, not saying. Maybe. Maybe that's in the cards. That's always a good ender at the end of the day, I'll say that.
All right, let's take a trip back down the road. I guess we'd probably be heading west from Shinnecock over to Bethpage. Is that the right direction? Am I heading the right way here?
Yeah, you are, because the further out east you go, you get out, you know, all the way out there to Montauk. But yeah, we're coming back in. It's not that far from Manhattan. It's certainly not way out there where Southampton is. Mm-hmm. So it's Farmington, New York, I think is the actual address of it, or the city or the town.
It's coming up, Danny.
Have you been there? Have you been to Bethpage?
I played the Northern Trust there. This was in 2016. So I have been there, and it's awesome.
It's one of my favorites in the area too, as well. It's a big 6.5 mile walk out there. They're making that first tee, like wrap around from the 18th green around the first tee so they can get more people for the hoopla, the first tee, and they can just hang out there and leave, you know, watch a match, come back to 18 if they can. So, I cannot wait for Bethpage. It's going to be, you know, sometimes you overhype things and sometimes they don't deliver, but I'll guarantee you Bethpage, that Ryder Cup is going to be one of the all-time atmospheres in the history of golf.
I mean, especially just with the golf course, the New York fans, the strength, I would say, of the European side, and knowing that the motivation from that side to win on foreign soil, that kind of seems to be honestly more important, is who can win the away game and who's going to be the team to lose at home. To me, that's the big storyline that I'm excited about. And I just have no idea who's going to be on this American team. We talked about it with kids, and JJ Spahn just, I think, played his way onto the team based off of points. You expect him to be on the team, obviously, now. And I'm wondering how many rookies are going to end up on this team for the Ryder Cup for the American side. What do you think?
I think it's going to be really interesting, because you know there's going to be guys throwing in there for the first time ever. And oh, by the way, we're at Bethpage, where the atmosphere is off the charts. I'm like, how did I get myself into this? But we're going to see some first timers, I think, for the American side. You know, I don't know how it's going to exactly shake out. I think the Keegan Bradley thing is incredibly interesting. Mm-hmm. I keep bending Kiz's ear. I don't know if you guys talked about that.
We did. We talked about it.
Yeah. What did Kiz say about Keegan?
I asked him, I said, I want you to put yourself in Keegan Bradley's shoes, and I want you to tell me what your mindset is as a golfer heading into, you know, Ryder Cup selection. Are you more or less nervous about playing well week to week to try to make this team? Or do you feel like it's, you know, I just go out and play golf, and wherever the sticks chat or the chip stack at the end of this is, you know, we'll make a decision as a team. It seems I couldn't exactly get a feel for it, but Kiz kind of was at the end, just basically said that, nobody's going to be able to tell him to play on the team. He's going to have to decide for himself.
Yeah, that's been Kiz's response when I've asked him about it. And so this is a TBD, you know, to be determined.
Right.
Just to see how well Keegan continues to play. I don't see him backing off. I think he's just in a great spot in his career. I think he thinks it's kind of cool that he's the Ryder Cup captain and is good enough to play with his side, you know, potentially. So I don't think he's going to back off. I think that's going to be really interesting to see if he ends up playing at Bethpage, where he used to sneak on when he played at St. John's as a kid. I mean, you know, that's a great storyline. It's going to be cool as well.
I personally think he's one of the best 12 players over the last two seasons. I think he should be on the team. I think if it was any other captain, they would look at his history of how much he's played at Bethpage. He fits the profile of a perfect teammate. He's a great locker room guy. And of course, he's the captain. We know this, but I'm selfish in thinking that because the Ryder Cup is different than the President's Cup, and that there's four matches in the morning, four matches in the afternoon on Friday and Saturday, it's different than the President's Cup, where there's five matches going out and only two guys sit. Really, he could play in the morning both days on Friday and Saturday, sit in the afternoons and captain, and then go play Sunday. It seems like it would make sense that you always have a bunch of guys sitting. Some guys don't even play in a full day.
Yeah. Let's not forget that. Let's just say he is a player on the team and he gets out there and God forbid he doesn't perform well. And then you're going to hear about, you know, everybody say, oh my God, I can't believe he's trying to take on all this responsibility. Yeah. He was playing well and probably deserved to be in the top 12, but it's very clear that Keegan Bradley can't, you know, you can't captain and play the same time in this event. I mean, you know, but that's the thing about the Ryder Cup, right? It's the armchair quarterbacks at home that are going to sit sure. there and second guess everything. And, you know, the losing captain of a Ryder Cup is, it's a tough position. It's, I mean, how many times have we seen these guys just get roasted and it's really not their fault. I mean, you can just go on and on and on about pairings and the deep dives and the analytics and stuff. It comes down to those 3 days. How are those guys handling things? And sometimes we get a little bit too much into the numbers and go, well, he should have put so-and-so with so-and-so. It's sports, and they're either going to make it happen and perform or they're not. And some of those younger guys that are coming up are either going to handle the moment or not. So that's what makes the Ryder Cup, though.
Can you imagine the first guy to tee off in the Ryder Cup, a playing captain, Keegan Bradley on the tee?
Oh, man.
I mean, that is exactly what I want to see. But
yeah, I would have seen Keegan get in there and do the, you know, the club spinning around and the, you know, the place is going crazy and just pipe it down the middle for Team USA.
The New York fans just shotgunning beers at 7 a.m. after he tees off. I mean, it's just doing the beer bongs, the whole thing. Oh, I mean, that's exactly what this event is going to be. It's going to be chaotic. I'm excited to work it. Going to be walking up. That's not an easy golf course to walk now. They think about it with the hills out there.
So get yourself in shape for that one, Smiles.
That's right.
Get rested up.
That's right. And then a week later, we'll be having a kid. So
congrats on that. Awesome.
There you go. Well, Danny, a lot of fun this U.S. Open. Happy Father's Day to you. And gosh, we'll all see you next. I guess the Open Championship, where we got plenty of storylines there. Who's your pick on the way out?
Ooh, you know, I have picked literally for the last two. I picked at the Masters. I picked Shane Lowry. I picked him for Oakmont. I can't go with him again at Portrush. I mean, I could. But that would really be pushing the envelope. You know, it's probably going to be one of these guys trending. I love that golf course, though. I cannot wait. You're going to love it. It's my favorite in the rotation. Now, St. Andrews is special, the town, the whole thing, and that's off. That's kind of in its one category by itself. But the ruggedness and the feel of Portrush. So you know what? Hell with it. I'll go with Shane Lowry. I think he's going to get it together.
The storyline doesn't write itself better than that.
I mean, you know, I wish I could say Rory, but I don't know where he is, and I don't know where he will be by then. I hope he starts playing better and kind of gets everything tied down a little better. But so on the record here, Smiley, this will be played back on one of your podcasts. That Dan Hicks went with Shane Lowry to win at Portrush again. Mic drop.
There it is, folks. There it is. Don't even need to watch the Open. Make sure
don't
you turn
to watch.
Turn
don't
on your TV. We need the ratings, so just keep
That's
it on
right.
so you don't
Correct.
Mind. All right, Danny. Joy the Wing Foot member guest this weekend.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. I'll be at the member guest while Kiz is playing and his member guest and. Somewhere in the beautiful mountains of North Carolina. And from what I understand, Brad Faxon is in the field.
It is the announced team major championship
announced
week.
Announced team major championship. Huge, huge week in golf. In fact, I'm surprised that you won't be streaming it live on the Smiley Coffin Show. Or maybe there was, you know, come on, do a happy hour at Wingfoot on Friday's
man.
Play.
A little walk and talk wouldn't hurt a guy after coming off a 6-net 5.
There you go. Smiley, always
Danny.
A pleasure, pal.
Appreciate
Good
you,
to
buddy.
See you, man. Thank,
thank
you.
You. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Really fun recap, putting a bow on the U.S. Open at Oakmont with Kevin Kisner and Dan Hicks. Always fun talking to those two guys. And Smiley, now we turn the page to. It's crazy how this golf calendar is flying by. I'm looking at the one and done sheet. We're getting ready today. There aren't very many events left to pick. We're running out of time here.
You haven't used Rory yet, have you?
I've not used Rory yet.
I love that you just decided to save him on a generational run. And now he's like, who knows if he even plays the rest of the year.
He's going to win at Portrush.
Are you going to take him there, you think?
We'll see. I mean, if I was you, I'd just use Sam Burns for a fifth time. So I have Ludwig back in play now, courtesy of your, I use him at AT&T, I'm campaigning, petitioning to have him back in play.
All right. Where do we stand on one and done?
Where we stand on one and done is you are doing very well. So in the FedEx Cup standings, you would be second underneath Scotty and above Rory, but you are third on the money list this year. I, courtesy of John Rahm, and of course we do that, we use the points for whoever he tied with because he doesn't get FedEx Cup points, he plays for LIV. But yeah. I'm 33rd on the FedEx Cup list and the money list. So
all right, you're keeping your card now. You're keeping your card.
Not only am I keeping my card, but a couple good events in a row, and I might make it to East Lake. So that's where we want to be. I think that's maybe how we should do it. If we get to the end of the season, and if I'm not inside the cutoff, I don't get to pick for the next event because I didn't make it that far. So
I love that.
Thankfully, I should be able to make it there thus far. But you were doing very well. You're doing very, very well. So you got to tune in. We're about to hop off and record these. By the time you're watching this, we've already made the picks on Instagram. So good reminder to tune in. Follow us on Instagram at The Smiley Show every week. We give you those picks. And this week for the Travelers. So unless you got anything else, Smiley, I say we wrap this thing up and go make those picks.
Yep. And then just expect, I'm actually going to be playing Bethpage next Monday, which is exciting. We'll see how my game stacks up.
I was going to say, what word are we going to go with there for what that pitching to be like?
I'll go find my golf ball and hit it again. But I'll be there with ROX, one of my sponsors, and excited to be there and playing. But also, we're going to be recapping the Travelers Championship after this week. And then we're going to be talking to James Colgan, who broke the story about the new CEO of the PGA Tour, which we didn't discuss, I think we're going to have a really good interview with James. I'm excited to do that this afternoon. And I think it'll probably take a couple of weeks to really get a sense of the direction of the PGA Tour. But I think James will really help us kind of lead us in the right direction of what to think about this.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In addition to that Travelers recap, James on Brian Rolapp being appointed as a CEO, and the subsequent reports now that there is a plan to sunset Jay Monahan, and that should happen the next 6 to 18 months, I believe it is, and turn over the day-to-day responsibilities to a new CEO. So all exciting stuff. Can't wait to get James's thoughts on that. So look forward to that. Next thing in the feed that we have for you, and we appreciate you watching and listening as always. We'll talk to you right back here very soon.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our first lovely time fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the